My name is Ewan Whittaker. I've had the privilege of working longer for Dr. Kuiper than any other person, and what I want to try and do in this recording is to give some memories of the early days of his lunar and planetary researches and how this led up to the founding of the Lunar and Planetary Laboratory. I first met Dr. Kuiper in the fall of 1955, so what happened before that time I really don't know too much about. Looking through his list of publications here, which was recently compiled by his secretary Ida Edwards, it's quite obvious that his earlier researches were all to do with the stars, double stars in particularly, and close binaries and so on. But apparently he wanted to get into solar system astronomy, and his researches on double stars, of course, helped in this, because after all the solar system is kind of a binary or a multiple system, and we have the same things in the stars. So we noticed that, looking through these papers that he wrote, that as we get into the 1940s, the early 40s, the emphasis goes somewhat off the stellar researches and starts pointing towards the solar system. But he pioneered, of course, in the application of infrared astronomy to the objects of the solar system, and his early spectra of Venus, Mars, etc., with the discovery of certain molecules in the atmospheres of these bodies, are certainly pioneer efforts. He also discovered the atmosphere of the satellite Titan, and the other well-known discoveries, of course, are of the fifth satellite of Uranus, which he named Miranda, and the second satellite of Neptune, which was discovered shortly afterwards in a deliberate search for more satellites. So his first lunar researches appear to date back to about 1953, the fall of 1953, and on the results of about 1 year's observation of the moon with the 82-inch reflecting telescope of MacDonald Observatory, he wrote a remarkable paper called On the Origin of the Lunar Surface Features, which is in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, 1954. And I say it's remarkable because nowadays we have so many space programs, including of course the Apollo program, which have told us so much about the moon. So many of Dr. Kuiper's conclusions in this early paper have turned out to be very closely or completely correct. Of course, not every idea he puts forward is right. We know that some of the things are wrong, but most of the fundamentals are correct. For instance, he says here, "It will appear that the impact hypothesis is confirmed as the chief cause of lunar topography, but the source of the planetesimal is found to be neither meteorites nor small masses of the type that form the moon by accretion. Furthermore, evidence is presented that the moon was nearly completely melted by its own radioactivity some 0.5 to 1 billion years after its formation, and that the maria were formed during this epoch, and that they were not, as has been supposed, primarily the result of melting caused by the impacts themselves." Well, this has been confirmed absolutely by the Apollo measurements, the dating of the basalts from the maria, and it shows that this statement was completely correct. I first met Dr. Kuiper in 1955 at the meeting of the International Astronomical Union held in Dublin, Ireland that year. I was there as a youngish astronomer, and I had a colleague of mine, an amateur astronomer, and on one occasion we got together and said, "Hey, let's waylay Dr. Kuiper and see if we can't have a few words with him." We knew, of course, that he was a very busy man. He was at that time president of Commission 16 of the IAU, which is the commission which deals with lunar matters. And so we buttonholed him in one dark corner at one time, and we mentioned that we were very interested in lunar research, and we'd like to speak to him just for a few minutes if he could spare the time. He said, "Oh, of course we can. Let's go down to the refectory and have a coffee." So I believe he bought us each a cup of coffee and had one himself. And for about 10 minutes we discussed some urgent matters about the state of lunar nomenclature and lunar research in general. We were bemoaning the fact that professionals were doing very little about the moon, and that this was left to the amateurs, who had of course plenty of willingness to do what they could, but usually didn't have the scientific background to make good their results. So we had this little discussion, and then, as I recall, we had to move off because the next meeting was going to be held any moment. So we didn't converse any more at that meeting. However, he did put out a little memorandum here called "Considerations on a New Photographic Lunar Map," in which he was bemoaning the fact that there was no basic materials available for anyone who wants to do lunar research. The amateur maps were virtually useless for scientific studies anyway. The map of the International Astronomical Union, which was published in 1935, the map and catalogue, were all right more or less as a basis for the nomenclature, which you must use, of course, when describing the moon. You have to name the features that you're describing. But this, I had found out myself, was full of errors, and so this was the kind of thing we discussed. So there was this interim memorandum, and in this he was mentioning his ideas about the publication of some sort of photographic lunar atlas to help people with their researches on the moon. And along with this was another little piece of paper, statement on lunar nomenclature, and he'd found the same thing, of course, that the IAU nomenclature was good, but certainly not perfect. It needed updating. So following this meeting in Ireland, we both went our ways, of course, but from all the people in Commission 16 who received the statement and the interim memorandum, I was the only one who bothered to answer. And so this naturally started up quite a large correspondence between us, and we discussed by letter the pros and cons of this proposed lunar atlas of his, how it should be made, the format of the sheets, and so on and so on, the work that needed to be done in order to get the photographs together. And I have quite a large file of every letter from him where we discuss these aspects of his proposed atlas and how we should do it. So this went on for a couple of years. And then in 1957, he had by that time started quite an extensive program of photography of the moon with the 82-inch telescope at MacDonald Observatory. He'd made his own little camera for using 5x7-inch plates and films, and was using this to photograph the moon whenever it was possible. And in 1957 he had quite a collection of these plates, and in a letter he wrote sometime that year, he asked me whether I could possibly take, say, 3 months off to come out to Yerkes Observatory and to copy these moon photographs that he'd obtained. I had had a fair amount of experience of this back at Greenwich, copying my own photographs, and the process of copying photographs, lunar photographs, is really kind of a specialized one, and as he knew that I had some experience of this, he asked me to come out and see whether I could copy up these pictures of his. So the upshot of this was that he invited me out to Yerkes, paid my plane fares each way, and for a fairly short period, it was just over 3 weeks as I recall, I worked very hard in copying all these photographs up to a predetermined scale. And after that, we went back and started conversing a little more. He also, at this time, went to Lick Observatory, and on the way, he collected all the best photographs of the Mount Wilson collection, which were at that time among the best lunar photographs in the world, picked them up, went to Lick Observatory, and also picked up the famous Moore Chapel series of photographs which were taken there with the 36-inch refractor, and then worked with the Lick photographer in the dark room for quite a long period of time, making enlargements from these Mount Wilson and Lick negatives. This produced quite a large pile of prints, and then added to those that I'd made of his MacDonald pictures, this made quite a large collection. Well, all this time I think he must have had at the back of his mind that he wanted to set up some sort of project or institute, because in a letter here he says, "I have hoped for years to be able to start what may be called a planetary institute, and I have now received the necessary support for it." So this, I imagine, are his first thoughts about the lunar project at Yerkes and what was to be the Lunar and Planetary Laboratory here in Tucson. In 1958, he offered me a job on his new lunar project at Yerkes Observatory, and all the arrangements were made for my family and myself to spend, say, 3 years at this observatory and to participate in the work of the Lunar Atlas and any ancillary work that might have come along. Just a little prior to this, I had mentioned to him that I wasn't the only one who was interested in this project, but an amateur friend of mine by the name of David Arthur was also very interested in this. He was a professional cartographer, but as an amateur he was very keen on mapping the moon, getting positions of the features on the moon more accurately, and that he was very good at this. And so Dr. Kuiper wrote to David Arthur, and a little correspondence went between them, and he offered him a job also on this new lunar project. And this is typical, I found, of Dr. Kuiper's attitude. If someone could show that they were interested and enthusiastic about a job that he was hoping to accomplish, he would hire them with almost no hesitation whatever. Academic qualifications were not a necessity in this case, and he showed this attitude many times over the years. Well, this got to the fall of 1958, and so there was myself and my family, and David Arthur, who joined us shortly afterwards, and at the observatory there was Joe Tapscott, the photographer, and we had a student, Elliot Moore, who joined the project, and this was the original Lunar Project staff, as it was. Later we were joined by Barbara Middlehurst in 1959, who helped Dr. Kuiper with the editing of his books on the solar system series. But the actual Lunar Project was this other group I mentioned. Elliot Moore used to take photographs of the moon on every possible occasion with the 40-inch refractor. There were two ideas behind this. One was just to obtain good photographs of the moon for reproduction, possibly in this lunar atlas, which we were hoping to put together. And the other was to get plates for selenodetic measurements to improve our knowledge of positions on the moon. And this would be one of Mr. Arthur's projects. So the northeast turret in Yerkes Observatory was changed around a little. Desks and lamps were put in, and we started on our lunar project work in the end, about November 1958, as I recall, the first week in November 58. So this meant a lot of work. We had to collect all these many, many prints of the moon together, sort them out, check them to see which ones had defects and so on, and then decide which ones we were going to put together for the atlas, how they were going to be reproduced, and of course the usual problems of producing atlases. At the same time we were doing this and the lunar photography project with the 40-inch, we also had observing sessions down at the MacDonald Observatory with the 82-inch, and took many new photographs of the moon down there with that telescope. Another project which we started while we were at Yerkes was to try and make some sort of map of the moon which would be accurate as regards position. You see, prior to this, and especially with the IAU lunar map of 1935, the way of doing this was to start with an XY grid, ordinary graph paper, plot out the positions of all the known or all the measured craters, and then draw in the details between. Well, of course, when you draw details in like this, you never position them exactly. And so we had the idea of going about this the other way. Why don't we use the photographs of the moon and put our grid on top of this? So between the three of us, we decided how this would be done, and Mr. Arthur and I worked on this project of putting grids on the on these photographs from the lunar atlas in an attempt to make the most accurate map of the moon ever made. Well, we did most of the work of this while we were at Yerkes, although the printing didn't occur until we got down here in Tucson. Well, now let's back up very slightly to the summer of 1960, or the I guess it was a little earlier than that evening, even. Dr. Kuiper was, of course, director of Yerkes and MacDonald Observatories at that time, and the administrative work which he had to do in regard to this was a little bit much, and he wanted to do more research, devote more time to his planetary and lunar researches. And on a journey down to the University of Arizona here, he conferred with Dr. Cassander and Dr. Weaver, I guess, and was pretty much offered a position here at the University of Arizona. Well, he was quick to follow this up, and the result was that in the fall of 1960, the entire lunar project moved from Yerkes Observatory down here to the University of Arizona. And this was quite a large move. It involved a large amount of material had to be moved, of course. There was all the apparatus from the from our project, including a very large lunar globe, which we were going to use for globe photography, the rectified photography, and all our books and records and so on. Our early days down here were quite peculiar. There was just this little group of people. I'll read you the first personnel list that we had in alphabetical order here. There was David Arthur, who came from Yerkes, Anne Jeffrion, who, as I recall, was an astronomy student at Stewart Observatory, Ruth Horvath, who was assisting us with our lunar atlas work, Carl Hazen, was a geology student who was going to join us, Dr. Kuiper himself, Barbara Middlehurst, the editorial assistant, Elliot Moore, our student from Yerkes. There was Gail Moore, his wife, and they in fact had had their wedding ceremony shortly before at Yerkes in actually Dr. Kuiper's house. There was Toby Owen, another student, Lynn Owen, his wife, and myself. And this was the early personnel list for the Lunar and Planetary Lab. We were helped a lot in these days by Dick Cassander, and in fact in those days we were called the Lunar and Planetary Laboratory of the Institute of Atmospheric Physics, because for the first 3 months or so Dr. Cassander helped us very much with getting settled in, acquainting us how to deal with the paperwork of this university as compared with that of University of Chicago, and so on. We started work actually in some old Quonset huts on the campus, which were located approximately where the science library is now located. These old huts were spare. We had two out of the three, as I recall, and we were doing our work in these huts. The new physics, mathematics, meteorology building, which was going to house the Institute of Atmospheric Physics, wasn't quite complete when we arrived in August and September of 60. And so we used these huts for a little while, and then some of us moved up into the very west end of the Atmospheric Physics Department, which Dr. Cassander had made available to us. Something like, four rooms, as I recall. We had a library, Dr. Kuiper's office, one other office, Mr. Arthur's office, I guess that was, my office, a dark room consisting of two rooms, I think, and room for about three students. So after a while in the Quonset huts, we moved up into the Dr. Cassander's department, except that the heavier equipment stayed down in the Quonset huts. And what we did down there until they were pulled down was to start work on the rectified lunar atlas. Now, we'd obviously been thinking of this way back in Yerkes' days, and indeed the globe for this work, the 3-foot diameter aluminum hemisphere, was actually produced in, Rockford, Illinois, I think, before we came down here. So this globe was then used by myself, and particularly Mr. Spradley in those days, to rectify many photographs of the moon in preparation for a rectified lunar atlas. Well, I think I should now back up slightly to our Yerkes days once again, as thoughts come back into my mind. One of the things that I recall from these days was the visit of the Russian rocket experts. Their names were Academician Sedov, I think, and Dr. Blagonravov, as I recall, and there was one other gentleman whose name I've forgotten. And they were on a tour of the United States because the Russians, of course, were the first to orbit a satellite of the Earth. This was in, October of 1957, Sputnik 1. And they were also the first to hard land, a small object on the surface of the moon. So as a result of this, they were invited to the United States, and they called into Yerkes Observatory on their tour. So I can remember that very well. The other item I should mention about our Yerkes days was our collaboration with the Air Force Chart and Information Center at St. Louis. They had heard about the lunar project being carried on at Yerkes Observatory under Dr. Kuiper. And because of the space program was something which was just getting underway in those days, and the need for moon maps was going to be quite strong in the near future if men were going to the moon, they had the task of trying to map as much of the moon as they could. And because we were the only other people in the United States who were working on problems of the lunar surface and mapping and so on, they came to us for help and advice, and this turned out to be an extremely valuable association for us, certainly, and probably for ACIC as well. We collaborated in the making of their moon maps over many years, and on problems of nomenclature and so on, and the result of this, or the immediate result of this, was the preparation of the series of LAC charts. That's the LAC moon series. And they, over the years, they mapped over half of the front surface of the moon. The entire front surface was not completed in time, but that didn't matter. I don't remember all the representatives who visited us from ACIC way back there in 1959, but I think there was Mr. Carter, Mr. Cannell, a fellow, an artist by the name of Luber, who later left them, and there was probably a colonel or something. And we had a very cordial meeting, I remember, and this resulted in this collaboration between ACIC and us, and it was certainly very beneficial to us because they were the ones who prepared our orthographic atlas for printing at a local printer's here. Now, let me back up. I mentioned earlier that while we were at Yerkes, Mr. Arthur and I had gridded, or put these X and Y grids on a representative selection of photographs from the Chicago Atlas. Yeah, I haven't even described the Chicago Atlas. I should have said that while we were at Yerkes, we completed the selection of all those photographs from that very large collection of Mount Wilson, Lick, Peak du Midi, MacDonald, Yerkes plates, and it was all collected together, taken to Chicago, where it was printed by Keller's or Neller's printers in Chicago, and this was the photographic lunar atlas, which was the first of Dr. Kuiper's lunar productions, you might say. This was just before we left for Tucson, as I recall, although I don't think the entire atlas was completed until after we had left. I just don't remember the details now. But it was called the Chicago Atlas colloquially because it was certainly printed at Chicago. So, returning to the subject of the gridded sheets, we had put grids on the back of these sheets as accurately as we could, and then these were all sent to ACIC at St. Louis, and they produced some beautifully executed grids based on our penciled-in grids, from which they produced actual negative sheets, films, which they sent to us without cost, and from which we then were able to produce the orthographic atlas of the moon. Now you see, this was the second in a series, and the thoughts in Dr. Kuiper's mind were, let's first produce a photographic atlas of the moon. Okay, that was the Chicago Atlas. The next thing we must do is to produce some map in which we can get accurate positions of features on the moon. And this was the orthographic atlas which I've just described. This came out in two different versions, as a matter of fact. And one was published by the University of Arizona Press here, the other one by the Air Force themselves, although the contents were virtually the same. And there were two editions. One edition just had the normal XY grid on it, but ACIC, with their computer, computed the lines of latitude and longitude, made up the negatives for us, and then we made up another edition of the moon which had both the XY grid and the latitude longitude grid. So this came out in the early 1960s in its various editions, 60 and 61 as I recall, and this was certainly the most accurate map of the moon as far as positions went that had ever been produced, and indeed it formed the basis of all the subsequent maps which were produced by ACIC, and it's not until very recent years, with the orbiting of various spacecraft around the moon, that the system which we employed there has been changed somewhat, unless you get into technicalities, the difference between selenographic and selenocentric coordinates, but this map that we produced was certainly a pioneer for something like 10 years. The other project which was going concurrently with this, of course, was the Rectified Lunar Atlas project. This was number 3 on the list. And what we did in this case was to project pictures on this globe, as I've already mentioned. And we selected all the best photographs and made them up into another atlas, which was called the Rectified Lunar Atlas. This was published in Tucson in 1963, as I recall. And it was really just a collection of photographs of the moon with an astronaut's eye view. So that everything was rectified, the craters were all in their correct location, one with the other. And this was used for many years by lots of people. It turned out to be a very useful atlas, and of course it's now superseded in many ways by the orbiter photographs of the moon, but in those days it was a very useful atlas. Well, while all this was going on, Dr. Kuiper was very active in building up the Lunar and Planetary Lab here, and that first list that I read you of about 7 or 8 people rapidly grew in a very short time to 20, 30, 50, and it wasn't too long before the staff numbered about 100, and it expanded from the simple lunar project into many other studies, including, of course, all the planets, infrared studies, balloon studies, and so on. However, I'm not competent to go into all the details of these other projects. I've been engaged on the lunar side of things most of the time, and so I'll just stick to that. Okay, so these atlases and things were quite impressive, and apparently they impressed NASA. NASA was thinking about landing spacecraft on the moon, orbiting the moon and so on, and sending men to the moon by this time. And in order to get as much data as they could possibly do on the condition of the moon, positions and so on, they came to Dr. Kuiper for assistance. And the first of the NASA projects, other than the little Pioneer satellites, to go to the moon was the Ranger series, and Dr. Kuiper was asked by NASA to participate in this series right from its outset, which he did. I think this was roughly 1961. He acted as an advisor for the construction of the spacecraft, well, at least not so much on the construction side naturally, but on the settings for cameras and so on, the brightnesses of the moon to be expected, and so on. The Ranger series, there were 9 in all, as it turned out, but the first ones were really trials. Ranger 1 and Ranger 2 were just dummies, really, which were not intended to go to the moon. They were just trying out the new scheme of using a parking orbit around the Earth in order to send things to the moon. This part was successful, even though the spacecraft didn't go into their correct trajectories. Rangers 3, 4, and 5 all were unsuccessful for one reason or another. Of course, these were pioneer days, and as the mistakes were found in one mission, they were corrected, and then others would appear. So 3, 4, and 5 were not successful. Ranger 6 was the first of a different type of Ranger spacecraft. It had 6 TV cameras and little else on it. And even Ranger 6 was unsuccessful because there was a short circuit in the electronics as the spacecraft was going through the thin regions of the air. There was an arc, and that spoiled Ranger 6. But Rangers 7, 8, and 9 were successful, and Dr. Kuiper was the chief experimenter for the television experiment, which was the only experiment on the spacecraft anyway. And I can well remember the days when he was a chief experimenter, he'd made me or asked me to be a co-experimenter along with Gene Shoemaker, Harold Urey, and there was one fellow from JPL, the name of Heacock. So this was the scientific team who would advise on the settings of the cameras for the brightnesses of the moon, where we should land these things, and so on. And these were very exciting days, naturally, and it was really a privilege for me to be asked by Dr. Kuiper to join this team to evaluate the photographs and work on the various range of projects. There's one little thing I might interject here with regard to Ranger 7. In those days, they didn't quite know where to land the things. They knew that they wanted to keep away from the rays on the moon, get into a flat area, because the astronauts would presumably land there. And for Ranger 7, they needed a target. And I just had a phone call from a young fellow at JPL one day. Dr. Kuiper couldn't be found. I was on the line, so he said, "Hey, we need to land Ranger 7 somewhere on the moon. Can you find a place that's in the right relationship to the terminator for such and such a date and such and such a date in case there's a slippage and so on?" So I just very hastily looked at a picture of the moon and said, "Oh yes, there's a good site there at such and such a place. If you land there, you'll be away from the worst of the lunar rays and you shouldn't hit the highlands," and so on. Very, very informal. And it turned out that that's the place that Ranger 7 was aimed at, and that's where it landed, in effect. And so we got all this tremendous amount of photography back from Ranger 7, and the various experimenters on the team then went back to their various institutions and conferred with colleagues and so on and produced the Ranger 7 report, which was our first close-up views of the moon. I hope we can find a copy of Dr. Kuiper's remarks that he made at JPL during the nationwide TV hookup that day after Ranger 7 had been successful. After so many failures, I don't remember his exact words, but he said, "This is a great day for America and a great day for science. Ranger 7 has gained not a factor of 10 nor a factor of 100, but a factor of 1,000 in resolution of the lunar surface." And he was obviously elated over this, and so was everyone else, naturally, that the United States had achieved the first close-up pictures of the moon. So from that day on, he and many people in the lab here collaborated closely with NASA on the following lunar projects. The next one after the Ranger, of course, was Surveyor. And here he and I divided somewhat. I was invited to join the television team for the Surveyor project, and Dr. Kuiper was on the Lunar Theory and Processes team. So that's the way Surveyor worked out, and then of course the 7 Surveyors went to the moon, 5 of which were successful, and I was the one who found where the Surveyors had landed, and this was really another privilege for me to even to be in on the Surveyor program. But at least I had a little bit of use, I guess, by finding out where these Surveyors had landed. Following Surveyor, there was the Orbiter, with which we were not connected too much. Our main connection for the Lunar Orbiter was with Lunar Orbiter 5, and our main task there was to select scientific sites that this orbiter could photograph and give us some details, close-up details of these particular objects. So we spent a certain amount of time together on deciding which objects on the moon should provide some useful data on the nature of the lunar surface. And I was actually on the team that went to Langley Field in Virginia and picked out some of these interesting lunar sites. Following the orbiter, of course, we had the Apollo program, and by this time Dr. Kuiper had so many projects going here in the Lunar and Planetary Lab that he did not participate in the Apollo program particularly. So I was the only one who actually participated here, and I was on the one of the photographic teams for the choice of scientific sites for the astronauts to photograph. Well, I seem to have got a little ahead of myself here, and let's now back up quite a few years. We've got to go back to roughly 1960, because there was another project which was started up at that time, and that was the updating of the IAU catalogue and map of the Moon, which I've already mentioned. This was the 1935 production, which needed updating, and once we got to Tucson, Mr. Arthur collected a small staff of about four people, and between them they worked for several years, something like 4 years, on completely updating this IAU catalogue and map of the Moon. This meant checking the positions and diameters of many thousands of craters, and was quite a long and tedious task. However, it was finally completed, and this catalogue came out in four sections, published in the Communications of the Lunar Lab, and it was accepted by the International Astronomical Union as the standard nomenclature for the Moon. At the same time that this work was going on, this was in the middle of the 1960s once again, and with the Ranger program, we had all these photographs from the Ranger spacecraft, of course, and in order to study these adequately, we needed to know what we were seeing in the photographs, compare the various little features we could see here with anything we could find on Earth. And so Dr. Kuiper set up a program whereby we could fly over various lava flows, volcano fields, and so on in the southwest region of the United States here, and see for ourselves just some of the processes which go on in volcanic flows. We also visited Meteor Crater, of course, and flew over that and visited it when I walked down to the bottom and back again. And all this was just a general broadening of our knowledge of features on the Earth which might have a somewhat similar origin to what we were seeing on the Moon. So this was quite a concentrated effort in the 1964-65 region, and we visited many volcanoes and lava fields. And in the reports on the Ranger missions, you'll find many comparisons between these flows and what we were seeing in these new Ranger pictures. At the same time, Dr. Kuiper's efforts with NASA got us a nice sum of money from which we could have a large telescope erected. This led him into some site testing efforts. He went in a small plane, flew over Kitt Peak and over the Santa Rita Mountains to the south of Tucson here, and also over the Catalinas. He got data on the Graham Mountains to the northeast of here, and decided that the best sites were probably Kitt Peak and the Catalinas. Well, there were various reasons why we couldn't get to Kitt Peak, the main one of course being the lack of space up there. It was a very small peak, and already Kitt Peak and Stewart Observatory were there, so there wasn't much space there. The access to the Santa Rita Mountains was rather tough. The mountain road was very poor, and in order to get the equipment up there would mean the expenditure of a lot of money. The Graham Mountains, as I recall, were far too wet. They were just sufficiently far northeast of Tucson. It's a long journey to get there, and the amount of cloudy weather in the summer was considerably more than around here. So he decided to have our telescope erected in the Santa Catalina Mountains, and this necessitated the making of no road at all. We didn't have to spend out any money on a highway because it's already there. And after long consultations with the Forest Service, he secured the site where the 61 inch now stands. So with this okay from NASA to spend some of the money on the 61 inch telescope, the university came up with a somewhat similar sum of money. The NASA money went on the telescope and instrument itself. The university money went on the building, and that's how we got our 61-inch telescope. And Dr. Kuiper's idea behind this was to get the very best optical telescope that we could for the 60-inch size, and to have it in a site which was reasonably accessible and yet high enough to be above the inversion layers and where the seeing shouldn't be too bad. Of course, over the years we've found that this has proved to be the case. The seeing at this site is good most of the time. It's not perfect. Nowhere it is, of course. And from this telescope we've been managing to get, over the last 8 years or so, some of the very best photographs of the moon and planets that have ever been taken. In fact, our first project with this telescope was to photograph the moon on every possible occasion, and this we did for a matter of about 16 months. And then from these 4,000 or more photographs which we obtained, we made yet another photographic lunar atlas. This was called the Consolidated Lunar Atlas, and it was really an updating of the old Chicago Atlas, which had been made with photographs taken over the last 50 years. But the Consolidated Atlas consisted, or 95% of the pictures or more, were taken with this 61-inch telescope, and the resolution of virtually every photograph is equal to or better than those in the old Chicago Atlas. So this ended the series of lunar atlases of one sort and another, which Dr. Kuiper had at the back of his mind since the late 1950s. So we had the Chicago Atlas, the Orthographic Atlas, the Rectified Atlas, the Consolidated Atlas, and the four catalogs updating the old IAU catalog and map of the moon. Well, let's mention kind of briefly what I can think of on the spur of the moment as regards the early days of the lunar project and how that it expanded into the Lunar and Planetary Laboratory. Perhaps I should say, if I can think of anything, about some personal recollections of Dr. Kuiper over the years. I think the first recollection that sticks in my mind was in 1957, when I came out for that 3 months of 3 weeks of copying lunar photographs. I arrived at O'Hare Airport at Chicago, which in those days was hardly more than a group of old cattle sheds, and he was there to meet me with, as I remember, Dolphus and Clayton Smith. And I was feeling extremely tired after the flight across the Atlantic in an old DC-7 airplane, and everyone in Chicago was bright as a daisy. It was 10 o'clock in the morning and I'd had no sleep for 25 hours or something. And then we went out to the carport to look for the car Dr. Kuiper had driven in. And we went up and down the aisles, and he could not remember for the life of him where he'd parked this car. And he said, well, it should be easy enough to see. It's a shocking pink colour, a large Oldsmobile. Well, of course, I didn't know what an Oldsmobile looked like, but I looked out for this pink car, and, well, eventually he found it, but it struck me rather funny that how the dickens could you lose such a huge car as a large Oldsmobile and of that beautiful pink colour, which turned out to be a shop sample. So I was rather laughing rather at the time, although he was really concerned. I'm sure he was quite annoyed with me for laughing, but I think it was just the fact that I was so tired that anything would have made me laugh or cry. Anyway, he drove us into Williams Bay, and I got into the Van Bee's house and was made very welcome. And I think I slept for 18 hours or some such time. Another small incident which sticks in my mind from some early observing runs at MacDonald Observatory, and I think this typifies Dr. Kuiper's very broad knowledge of scientific subjects. I happened to be looking up at the sky. The sun was behind some clouds. There were some beautiful rings around the sun, and I pointed this out, saying, "Hey, look at the halo around the sun." "Ah, yes," he says, "the particles making that halo must be so many microns in size." I said, "Oh, how did you figure that out?" So then he says, "Well, we have the angular diameter of the yellow ring is so many degrees, and this means that the particles from the wave theory of light are such and such a diameter." And this was typical of the tremendous grasp he had of all aspects of astronomical science. Another time comes to mind, and this was way back in the early 60s after we'd moved to Tucson, and we had an observing run at MacDonald Observatory. We'd traveled there separately, as I remember, but for the return journey, I seem to remember I was driving my own car and Dr. Kuiper was my passenger. And for a mere high school graduate such as myself to be driving this giant of astronomical science some 500 or 700 miles, I remember thinking at the time, "My goodness, here have I got Dr. Kuiper in this car, and if I do some stupid driving and go off the side of the road or something, what a loss to the world this will be." And kind of an awe-inspiring thought. I can remember thinking this at the time. However, we were discussing all sorts of things about the resolution of telescopes and the resolution photographs of the moon, and this went on just about all the way home. So the 7 or 8 hour drive from MacDonald back to Tucson, the time went very quickly, and I did not drive off the side of the road. It was perfectly safe, and that was the end of that little episode. Another little totally non-scientific episode I remember was during this same run at MacDonald, I guess it was, when we were the only ones there, and I know I wanted to have a bath, and I'm used to, when I'm having a tub, to really scrub myself with a kind of a pot scrubber, the nylon pot scrubber type of thing. And I went into the kitchen of the director's house there, where he was pottering around in the kitchen, and fished under the sink and pulled out this nylon scraper. He said, "Oh, what are you going to use that for?" I said, "I'm going to have a bath. I want to get myself clean." I can remember the look of consternation on his face that anyone would use a nylon pot scraper to really get their skin all tingly, but I always have done that, and I think it really surprised him at the time. Well, that's given just a few little personal glimpses that I've had over the years with Dr. Kuiper. Of course, I could think of many, many more incidents that I remember, but I think that'll do for now, and so I'm going to end this tape right here.